Princeton. We will carry on, I hope, till about 12:15. If you feel like a cup of coffee at any time, please feel free to get up and help yourself and come back again. This isn't a formal sort of setup. After I've called on Joe Jorgensen, I'll call on Ralph Johnson to carry the discussion from there, and then I'll call on Ada Deer, and after that, maybe we can just play it by ear. So Joe, forgive me, you just begin now, if you would.
Thank you, Justice Berger, and distinguished participants. It's indeed an honor to be here. I've Mr. Justice, Chairman.
Not right. Justice Berger, the name is Berger. And, there's a reason for making that distinction.
Yes, there is. I take it. Sorry.
Forgive me. Yeah.
It's a great pleasure to be with Ada Deer. It's the first time I've seen her with my own eyes. I've seen photographs. This must seem like instant replay to you to go through the histories of a corporation and tribal struggle and redemption. We haven't gotten to redemption for Alaska, it looks like, but this is a replay of the Menominee case. I'm glad you said that we could run over history and political philosophy, because that's what I've prepared, some history. And I do want to go back to the European discovery of the continent, because the first question posed by the European discoverers were whether the natives they encountered were humans, were God's children, were the progeny of Adam. And that required the Pope to resolve that one, and he did, in the favor of Indians. And it was also determined a few years thereafter by Francisco de Vitoria, that Indians were the possessors of their land, that Europeans did not acquire the land by discovery. They did not have title. Title was vested in Indians. And so any transfer of title required the honest purchase through the understanding of Indians about that conveyance. Hence, treaty making was established, and many, many treaties were made between emissaries of European powers and Indian tribes. They weren't always made, and land obviously was taken from natives, and resources were destroyed, but the policy was intact, that that's the way things should be. And the policy held. Most nations and their emissaries observing it, until the Articles of Confederation and the creation of the United States. And in fact, they continued on even then. But two important things happened in the United States following the Articles of Confederation and following thereafter. The first, of course, was the Indian Non-Intercourse Act of 1790, which gave to the federal government the sole authority to approve business conducted with Indian tribes, hence to oversee the commerce with the tribes. But the second important item, I think, was the decision in Johnson versus McIntosh in 1823, when the Justice Marshall redefined Indian title. And Indian title in this new definition was impaired. I take it that that was something like usufruct, where Indians possessed the land for its traditional uses. But the title became that of the United States government by discovery. And that in the future, treaties would be signed with Indians to convey that title to the United States or some other public agency or business, but that Indians would be compensated for that conveyance by treaty. The federal government continued then as the protector of Indian land. Indians had the right to it for its use, but the title was impaired. Over the next several years, but especially in the Cherokee cases that were, again, the opinions written by the Supreme Court and Justice Marshall, the nature of tribes and their sovereignty was defined. And it was defined as domestic dependent nations. They were, each Indian tribe was considered to be independent of other tribes of the states, but it was, had a domestic dependency to the federal government. Other nations could not deal with the tribes, nor could states within the United States deal with the tribes. Yet, internally, tribes governed their own affairs, and their right to do so was to be protected by the federal government. No sooner had Marshall written his opinion, the second opinion in the Cherokee cases, than the President Jackson, who had approved and Indian Removal Act of 1830, allowed the state of Georgia to take Indian land, which is to say to deal directly with the natives and to deny them their sovereignty. And in fact, the natives, many of them east of the Mississippi, through tortuous steps, were removed, not all, but many, to west of the Mississippi, where Indians already resided, and they were pushed into space already occupied, space that they were told would be theirs forever, so long as the river shall run and the grass shall grow. Thereafter followed a period of about 40 years of treaty signing, and it went something like this, that the frontier expanded westward, and each step of the way required the conveyance of Indian land to non-Indians. And so treaties were signed, and usually treaties meant that for the cession of lands to the United States, Indians would receive annuities or gifts, they would receive protection and peace, and often there would be other federal aid proposed and offered to the tribes. Tribes would sign as many as four or five treaties over a period of these 40 years, some tribes. 370 were signed in all, and during this period, the tribal estates, of course, decreased greatly in size. The movement throughout the period in reduction of land was to place Indians on reservations, and as their populations dwindled and as they rebelled and as warfare was conducted among them, there was still greater interest to constrict and restrict the travels and the movements of Indians. When treaties were signed then, they were not all signed from goodwill or out of goodwill, but the estimate is that $500 million was spent on the Indian Wars in the 1850s, 60s, and up to about 1870. The way in which Indians were treated as this limited sovereignty of theirs began to change as early as the 1860s. But the clear and distinct change in policy, the federal government toward Indians, was not until 1887. By the 1860s, for instance, the Kansas Kickapoo, who had been moved from the Great Lakes to Indiana, where they rebelled, to Kansas and some to Oklahoma, but to Kansas, These people have been given a 792,000 acre reservation. They had had it reduced to 300,000 acres. They had it reduced yet again to 70,000 acres. And finally, in about 1868, a bill was passed that gave to each male Indian adult 160 acres of land. And it gave to each woman and child 40 acres of land. And so there was about 7,000 acres that was given as allotments that would be held in trust for 20 years, at which time the Kansas Kickapoo could be in the mainstream of the agrarian Midwest, able to sink or swim, depending on their own skills. You'll know this act, of course, as something very, very similar to the act that was passed in 1887, the General Allotment Act. Similar kinds of acts were offered many times, bills were offered many times in Congress, with great push in 1877 to cede the lands of Colorado, especially rich in gold, silver, lead, to the federal government and open it up for mining claims. For 10 years, there was a struggle in Congress over this act, the General Allotment Act. The argument went something like the argument people listened to last week. If Indians are to, Indians should not be treated differently from citizens of the United States. Indeed, it is their very communal behavior that is a drag upon them, that causes them not to be individual, successful, responsible persons. That they are being carried by taxpayers, by citizens, and they are not using the resources which they possess. Resources are not there to be looked at alone, but they are to make a person and to make a nation great. And so the argument that was conducted on the floor of the House and the Senate over a 10-year period saw that there was a solution to the Indian problem. The wars had finally been terminated, or nearly so. The Indian population was dwindling. The Transcontinental Railroad had been completed. A series of acts had been passed which opened land to the public domain. The Homestead Act, the Timber and Stone Act, the Stone Act, the Mining Act. Each of these acts encouraged residents from the East to move west, take up land, develop it, and connect the great metropoli east and west. The railroads had been given huge tracts of land across their rights of way, across the continent for their own development. And they too encouraged residents in the East to buy their land and to locate along the railroads. Each of these things put more pressure on Indians, but also more pressure to relinquish resources that were not being used. And so, in 1887, Congress passed the General Allotment Act. I passed up an important point. In 1871, Congress had previously passed an act that denied Congress would again allow treaties to be signed with American Indians. And this was a rider attached to a bill for appropriations in 1871. And so after 1871, Indians did not have treaty-making powers. That is to say, they were no longer able to make treaties. Agreements then were signed with tribes. And perhaps 230 or 240 agreements were used rather than pass a special act of Congress each time the federal government desired some land conveyance or transfer from Indian title to the United States. So by 1887, Indians had already lost these treaty stipulation powers, and the General Allotment Act was passed. The act clearly sought to dissociate Indians from their tribes, from their communities, and to transform their persons, their personalities. Indeed, if Indians would but accept an allotment of land, the title to be held in trust for 25 years, and if they would but change that title to patent in fee, and if they would then move to a city, they would become citizens. Until that time, there were few ways to gain citizenship, but this was one. The idea behind this, then, was that if a person is responsible for soil, if they're responsible also for a family to provide from them for the soil, if the land is on a state tax roll, they're responsible for paying taxes for it, that they take on the responsibilities of citizenship, then are entitled to it and entitled to the vote. So the General Allotment Act of 1887, as it was initially framed, thought that you would cut up tribal estates, give them to persons, and in the initial act, there were 160 acres for each adult male, 40 acres for women and for children. The act was soon revised so that in reservations where there was little irrigable soil, a person might gain 320 acres. The way the act was actually administered varied widely on reservations. On some, chiefs were given two or three or even more allotments. Women received none, children received none. There were no lands provided for future generations. On some reservations, all adults received 80 acres. The way in which it was administered varied very considerably. But there were no provisions for future generations. And there was an act in 1890 passed that encouraged the transfer and the change of title to patent and fee to make those who accepted it citizens. From 1887 to roughly 1934, most Indian policies changed to focus on the individual nature of Indians and dissociating them from federal protections and federal responsibilities to push them into the mainstream. This is a considerable change, of course, to the legislation that and the policies that preceded 1887, where tribes were treated with as if they were domestic dependent sovereigns. Some of the acts that were crucial were those that gave to local Indian agents or to the Secretary of the Interior the power to declare competency and thereby to allow persons to transfer their title to fee patent. This allowed, of course, for the conveyance of huge amounts of Indian land. In part, this was prompted by airship problems that had occurred. Many, many of the tracts of land that had been allotted became entangled in airship. As the allottee died, there had been no provision, no explicit provision for airship, and no simple way to resolve the problem of who would have title to the land. Also, states intervened and desired to move land in airship status onto state tax rolls and to use state probate procedures for those for the land. So that caused a caused several disputes between state and federal government, resolved by the federal government on the side of Indians, where trust status was extended over over the land that was held in airship, and states were denied the right to enter airship land onto the tax rolls. By 1924, the Citizenship Act was passed without consultation from American Indians, which gave to all Indians, not just those who had removed their allotments or airship land to patent and fee status, but to all Indian citizenship, the right to vote, the right to act as any other citizen individual in the United States. I don't know whether it was hoped that the Citizenship Act would complete and culminate the sweep of legislation from 1887 on, but it was focused in that direction. But just 2 years later, Lewis Merriam was commissioned by Secretary of Interior Work to assess the conditions of Indians throughout the United States. That Indian rights groups had formed earlier and were now unhappy with the conditions of Indians, those they sought to help, and they were influential in causing an investigation of Indian affairs, to look at land problems, to look at the problems of education, of health, of employment, of development on reservations, of the land estate. 140 million acres possessed by reservations, Indians in 1887, had been reduced to 32 million acres by about 1932. The Merriam Report investigated education, showed it couldn't be much worse, that for America's minorities, this the education system was the least acceptable. They had been in a program for 35 years or so of removing Indian children from their families, putting them in Indian schools, and giving them trade educations. In the schools, however, if children became sick or if they died, it was not uncommon in the Mountain West, parents often sought to have their children returned home, but pressures were put on parents not to do so. And the pressures were straightforward. They refused to give annuities, to pay benefits, or in some instances to recognize Indian leaders who spoke in behalf of tribes. So there were considerable pressures put on to remove children from their homes and put them into Indian boarding schools. Merriam thought that that was unworkable and that the Indian education system should be changed and that Indians should be returned home. Health must be improved because no population in the United States measured at that time suffered from so high rates of tuberculosis, trachoma, gastroenteritic diseases, nor had such high mortality and morbidity rates and low birth rates. The Indian service was looked at to find incompetent, often racist employees. And Merriam reported that if you would but give more money to the Indian Service, you'd get better class of of people working for them. That if you would pump money into Indian affairs, you would have better health and better schools. And so the Merriam Report suggested ways to resolve some of the problems, at least the symptomatic problems that American Indians were suffering. But to bring them back to the reservations, or to bring them back to their homes, was a very important one. The Merriam Report was important in the next swing of legislation, which went from this individualization, this program to personalize and to make each person responsible and to dissociate Indians from their tribes, to bring them back to the reservations. And with the New Deal government of FDR in 1932, and with the appointment of FDR's first Commissioner of Indian Affairs, John Collier, Collier worked hard for the passage of the Wheeler-Howard Act, or the Indian Reorganization Act. The act itself was intended to draw Indians back to reservations, to preserve some aspects of their culture, to restore certain aspects of the culture, but to change other aspects so that Indians on reservations could cope successfully and live adjacent to non-Indians near their reservations. And so the Indian Reorganization Act would do several things. If Indians would but meet, and if the eligible voters in the tribe would ratify constitutions, Indian tribes could create governments, constitutional governments, that would allow them to control law and order, persons on the tribe, have the right to tax and so forth, to create then a public agency to direct and control the affairs on a reservation. The Indian Reorganization Act also provided for charters so that a tribe could incorporate and the governing body could promote business for the tribe, to create farms, ranches, railroads, own skyscrapers. I guess the sky was the limit. There was, however, no money for the tribal corporations, and there wasn't any money forthcoming for a couple of years for the corporations, although money was made available to buy up airship land and put it back into trust status, to buy allotment land and put it into trust status, and to buy land formerly owned by the tribe, ceded to the government, acquired either from through the public domain or through purchase by non-Indians, and non-Indians who lost their land to taxes in the 1930s or who merely wanted to get out from under heavy debts and would sell land. Between 1934 and 1950, about 18 million acres was purchased, and the tribal estates increased to about 50 million acres. During this period of the Indian Reorganization Act, it was clear that the kind of community that was being pushed for Indians was not the limited sovereignty prior to 1887, where Indian tribes ostensibly could make their own decisions and chart their own courses. But it was one that required the Secretary of the Interior to oversee a new form of government that itself was built on the model of local, state, and federal government, as well as all departments of government, executive, administrative branch, the legislative, and the judicial. But it also included business. By 1954, about three-quarters of all American Indian societies had were operating under provisions of the Indian Reorganization Act. The act had been extended to some parts of it to Alaska in 1936, and a similar act in 1936, the Oklahoma Indian Welfare Act, was passed on to Oklahoma, a state that had been tribalist since 1898 by law. Well, the Indian Reorganization Act did not provide funds to allow for the growth of successful corporate enterprises. It did provide funds for the reacquisition of lands, and it provided a new layer, a new level of authority over tribes that they hadn't experienced in the past. And that was the veto of the Secretary of the Interior. It may have provided for more power in the hands of the Bureau of Indian Affairs as they administered funds made available through Congress and entitlements to Indian tribes, and as they sought to mediate between Congress and the tribes. Soon after the Indian Reorganization Act was passed, and soon after Commissioner Collier set out on his policy to acquire land for tribes, he ran headlong into opposition in the Senate and in the House and in the states. And the opposition was to removing land from state tax rolls and putting it into a trust status. It was seen as the worst kind of a socialist enterprise. And it caused great grief for Collier and his office. Yet Collier went right ahead purchasing land and in some instances gaining the consent of tribes to pass the IRA provisions on their own reservation, doing so in rather shady fashions. Some tribes approved their IRA constitutions by a vote of 5-1, and the best I saw was a vote of something like 2-0 to approve a charter. That had to be the record. The way things could be approved by the voting eligible members who showed up, if they showed up and voted in a majority, the IRA provisions were passed. So there was some acrimony on some reservations over the mere passage of the act. And that often increased on some reservations, depending on who gained control of the Tribal Business Committee, a committee not only charged with running the government, law and order, passing legislation, then administering it, but also charged with doing the tribe's business. Land could be assigned for use by persons or by cooperatives. Land could be leased to non-Indians. A person on a business committee and his family may gain jobs in the tribe that were not available to other members of the tribe. So the kinds of factionalism that emerged, most social scientists could have predicted would emerge. And IRA governments had a bumpy career. They had a bumpy career with limited funds, and given the nature of their origins, and also given the nature of the constitutions that were provided to them, they were boilerplate, written in Washington, D.C., provided to the tribes, which they accepted. They could modify them, and some did. But the IRA governments provided for some external controls. And if an IRA government passed legislation or conducted business the tribal members in general disapproved, there was usually the provision for a general council or a tribal council meeting one or more times per year. And if a quorum met, they could rescind legislation, pass legislation, create new jobs, and so forth. So there were some provisions for the disgruntled tribal members to enter tribal affairs on a first-hand basis if they thought they were not being properly represented. Throughout this same period, though, there was a struggle in the Bureau of Indian Affairs with Congress. And so much of the vision of the Indian Reorganization Act got lost in the war effort, in the fight between Commissioner Collier and Congress, in the reduction of funds to the IRA during the war years, to the removal of the IRA offices to Chicago with just a small group left in Washington, D.C. during the war years, so that even the organization was separated. By the end of the war, during this short, bumpy history, many members of Congress were ready to spin Indian affairs the direction opposite from which it had gone the previous 12 years or so. It was time to, once and for all, solve the Indian question. So there was a replay of 1887. How do you do that? At the same time, be fair. The Indian Claims Commission Act was the first piece of legislation, I think, that sought to do that. It gave tribes several years in which they could make claims for broken treaties, lands for which they were not compensated, in annuities they hadn't received, injuries to person, rape, beatings, the destruction of the resources on which they lived. And they could bring these cases to the Indian Court of Claims. Previously, their only access to redress was through the Court of Claims, where they were bracketed with foreign nations, and where they required an act of Congress to sue the federal government. Many had tried. Several billion dollars worth of suits had been brought. A few million dollars had been awarded by the Court of Claims over the years until the Indian Claims Commission Act was passed. 370 cases were filed to the Indian Claims Commission. If the Indians were to have their day in court and to be compensated in cash for the treaty violations, for the loss of their land, which they were not compensated, then the books, the records would be clean, and the federal government would be absolved of its responsibilities to Indian tribes. The Indian Claims Commission set about adjudicating these various cases. And the first windfall was, as it was perceived by local non-Indians in Utah, where I resided as a child, was to a tribe next door to me, a language I happened to speak, a group that I knew well. And it was $31 million. Unheard of sum in 1950. And the $31 million was awarded to three Ute tribes, two in Colorado, one in Utah. And they were destitute. And they sought a per capita distribution of a large part of those funds. They had pressing needs for clothing, food, health. And so a large amount of those funds were provided after the attorneys took their fee, were provided to the tribe for precisely that purpose. The use of the funds as per capita payments. Soon thereafter, every allocation of those funds that were obvious to non-Indian residents nearby infuriated them. From alcohol, which was against the law for Indians to purchase at the time, to new refrigerators. And so the stories told about the Oklahoma Indians were told in Utah and Colorado as well, driving Cadillacs and leaving them in ditches. And there was considerable pressure put on the senator from Utah, Arthur V. Watkins, a sheep rancher, who was instrumental later as the commissioner of the Indian Claims Commission, but at that time the senator, who had been the key person in passing the next act to come down the road, which was termination legislation and the House Concurrent Resolution 108. The public response to the Indian Claims Commission Act, to these huge awards as perceived by struggling ranchers and farmers in the West and the Midwest, was the reaction was overwhelming. And there was no desire to see justice done if that justice somehow precluded themselves, that they were now in unfair competition with Indians around them. They had been given something to which they were not entitled. How many times do we have to pay for this land that is ours by discovery anyway? After all, Indians but roamed the land. They did not have government. They hadn't achieved a state of grace. The attitude you could know only if you lived near a reservation. But it was widespread, and it persists. Indians, again, had received something for nothing, and the taxpayer was paying even as he went into bankruptcy court, losing his own cattle or farm operation. Well, Congress and the Bureau of Indian Affairs did some interesting things with these claims awards that were made. They not only were slow to provide them, sometimes the House Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs intervened to say exactly how the money would be allocated and what it could not be used for. And they wanted to review the budgets that were prepared by tribes. Most instances they didn't, because that's a headache to do such things, and they had the BIA to do it for them. But in the Ute case, they wanted oversight after their excess of passing out per capita payments. For the monies used by the business committee and the tribal council being the same thing, all business operations were given rather close scrutiny, but only public expenditures of the income were usually quickly and freely approved. This was replayed again and again and again by Indian societies. And one thing that nettled them more than most were the offsetting costs that the federal government began exacting on the Indian claims awards after they had issued four or five without exacting offsetting costs. For those of you from tribes who've received such awards, you know what I mean when I say that if there's $30 million awarded and the government tallies up, we've spent $20 million on this tribe over the past 70 years. We've built fences for them. We've sent them to school. We've had BI administrators here. We've given them health, education, one gift after another. That's $20 million. The award might be $10 million provided to them after the offsetting costs. They pay for the benefits they receive from the federal government. With this in hand, the Indian Claims Commission doing what it was supposed to do, tribes also began to realize not only were the offsetting costs causing them to have really niggardly awards, but the $1.10 or $1.25 or 90 cent an acre also bothered them, which they were being compensated. But finally, they were bothered when, and they didn't realize this at first, that this was this claim to title that was being extinguished might not have to be extinguished. What they wanted was land, not money. What they were given was some money and not land. To retain ancestral land in perpetuity for future generations and for the past was what was desired. But where do you turn when all the force is on the other side and has been for so long? They turned and they looked right into the eye of termination legislation, House Concurrent Resolution 108, a sense of Congress saying we should proceed now and terminate Indians. We can do many things for them. We can move this Papago Hopi Rehabilitation Act, Navajo Rehabilitation Act, and send Indians to cities. We can relocate them, give them on-the-job training, sever their ties with the tribes. So that's one thing they did. They created then a Relocation Act from it. But we will terminate them from federal services as they are prepared to be terminated. 104 Indian societies were terminated following several special acts of Congress.